Perhaps you've made a mistake. You've put the sphere away somewhere in your laboratory and forgotten it. You've done it before, you know.
No, I've looked everywhere.
Oh, well, let's go home and look again, shall we? You know what you're like.
Yeah, but suppose...
Let's go and have a quiet dinner and you can tell me all about it. Then we'll go home and we'll look for the sphere.
Welcome to Who Worth Watching, where we're exploring this classic series from the beginning to see what's still worth watching for a modern audience. Today, we're talking about the second of two stories in a row that were lost for 40 years before being found in a television basement in war-torn Nigeria. This is the 1968 story, The Web of Fear. I'm your host, and when I was a little boy, I decided I wanted to be a podcaster, so I became one. Thank you very much. My co-host is Guy, who is in danger of getting kicked off the podcast if he keeps liking Doctor Who stories.
I'm not sure that's the disincentive you think it is.
Well, you know, the real problem is liking the wrong ones, you know. I mean, you're already sort of, you know, on parole for your naming heresy stuff. So. I had said previously that both of these stories, the previous one, Enemy of the World, and this had been completely recovered. I forgot that there is still one episode missing in this, which we will go over today. It's the third episode.
Oh, yeah, that was a little jarring when I got to it. But
yeah. At least I'll say they had a pretty good number of photos, and, you know, they did some little tricks with sort of zooming in on the photos and moving around. So it was, you know, it wasn't a bad reconstruction. We've had reconstructions where you kind of just don't know what's going on too much. There were a couple points.
It was bearable. Yeah.
Now, did you spot the Doctor Goes on Vacation episode?
I am guessing that is the episode two. Yeah. But,
I thought they actually did it pretty well. I like afterwards, I was like, wait a second, the Doctor wasn't in this one, but I didn't really notice.
Yeah, they do pack a lot of stuff into that episode.
I had said that, well, people, you know, from what they'd seen previously, didn't like Enemy of the World, and then when they got the whole thing, they liked it, and they thought this one was going to be great, and then they didn't like it so much. I'm probably overstating that a bit. I would say that, you know, before these were found, if only one of them could be recovered, previously people would have said this one, right? And after the fact, it would have been Enemy of the World. But this has its qualities, although I think the second half may be a little more disappointing, at least compared to what people expected, right? But from what they knew of the story, they'd heard about these sort of epic battles and stuff. And whenever you're thinking of Doctor Who and epic battles, it may not go quite the way you're thinking.
Yeah, don't get your hopes up too high.
Okay, episode one. And so coming off of the Enemy of the World, the TARDIS door is open after Salamander fell out. And the crew spends a few minutes pretending to almost fall out themselves. I notice lots of shots of Victoria's legs. You know, you're hoping that the skirt will ride up there or something. And after they get out of that whole situation, and the Doctor then says that Salamander is now trapped in time and space. So who knows? He could come back someday.
Yeah, I don't think the air is very, very good out there, but who knows?
And, you know, in classic fashion, we, you know, see this every few Doctor Who stories. Jamie says the Doctor can't control the TARDIS, and he gets annoyed about it and says, we'll see about that.
Yeah, we had that with, that goes all the way back to the Hartnell episode. Oh, yeah. She got real indignant.
Oh, yeah, like he's like, well, I'll just put you out, you know. Then we switch to an old man staring at what looks like our old friend the Yeti from the Abominable Snowman. And he seems very upset and he's kind of muttering to himself. And as we'll discover, this is Travers, again, the father of the actress who plays Victoria. And it's the same actor who played Travers in the Abominable Snowman.
Hmm.
And so, but he's playing him 30 or 40 years later. So he's much older in this. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, you know, he actually kind of reminds me of myself, actually.
Although, you know, he has it. So I actually really like this because The Abominable Snowman was only a few stories ago, right? So it's unusual to, it's not like we waited 2 years for this or whatever. And to get the same character but played 30 or 40 years later. And he's changed, right? I mean, he was a younger guy and he was sort of a spry whatever. And now he's sort of this doddering old guy who's, you know, not quite as on top of it as he used to be and is kind of cantankerous and, you know, that sort of thing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. He's not like elderly old. I'd say maybe late middle age, something like that.
Yeah. But,
with the Abominable Snowman, we never really got any video of him, did we? We always saw him as a cartoon, if I remember right.
Yeah, right. It was animated, yeah.
So I didn't recognize this was him until, you know, in episode two, Victoria recognizes him, which right. We'll get to eventually.
And so his daughter, Anne, comes in, and it turns out he was supposed to meet her at the airport, but he sort of forgot because he's been standing here staring at this Yeti. And she flew halfway around the world based on him sending her a cable saying that he was in trouble. And what we find out here is that Travers, you know, when he came back from Tibet, he brought a bunch of stuff with him, including a decommissioned Yeti, which, as we know, is a robot.
No.
And he sold it to this museum 30 years ago where they are now. But now he wants it given back, and the owner refuses. And I think they're kind of doing a Jewish stereotype here because he has a very Jewish name, as I recall. And he's
I was wondering that there's a little coding in there for the guy who owns the museum.
Yeah, he's like, you're trying to steal money from me. You know? Anne points out that the Yeti is helpless without a control unit, but Travers now reveals that he also brought back a control unit that was fully functional. And he had been tinkering with it, I guess, for years, and then it suddenly disappeared. As we know from the original story, control units managed to find their way to Yeti.
I think he may have, when he considered this robot to be defunct just because it didn't have a control sphere, that maybe he should have done something a little more thorough, you know, like snip every wire inside of it.
So the museum owner and Travers have a funny back and forth. This is where the owner's like, well, when you gave it to me 30 years ago, it wasn't worth so much, but now it's worth more, and you're trying to steal from me. And and so he refuses, and he ejects them from the museum, and then we see the control unit at the window, and of course it has a very distinct sound, too.
Yeah, it's just sort of hovering there under its own power, as control spheres do.
And the owner closes up the shop, and then he hears the control unit break a window, and he thinks it's Travers coming in to steal the Yeti. But when the owner runs into the Yeti, it now has glowing eyes, and it's not a good Yeti. It smashes the hell out of him.
Yeah, it's not one of those Yeti that just kind of ignores you. It's,
yeah.
It's more in your face.
So back in the TARDIS, the Doctor and Jamie are eating a sandwich as they debate. And I can totally tell it's an actor thing. Like, they were just like, we need something to do here. So they had a sandwich to eat. Because eating the sandwich has nothing to do with the story. It doesn't fit anything. It just gives them something to do with their hands.
Yeah.
Both Jamie and Victoria at different times here have pointed out there's a light flashing on the console. And the Doctor just refuses to believe them. Like, every time he looks, it's not flashing, right? And then he does see it flashing. And he says it means they're landing. He turns on the monitor, and he realizes they are suspended in space. Mm-hmm. And we then see the TARDIS get encased in a web, perhaps even a web of fear.
Well, at least they don't have to worry about the door opening suddenly.
And now we have a big change. We're seeing a journalist interviewing a soldier in a small room. We have no idea who these people are or where they are. And one of the things I like about this story, because I always like the ones that start, you know, the in media res, right? I like it when something's been going on for a while and then we run into it. It's not like we see it from the very beginning or that the TARDIS crew causes the story to happen or something like that.
Yeah.
So stuff's been going on for months, as we'll find out. And the journalist is interviewing the soldier. We hear about some guy named Pemberton who died, and the soldier is talking about, you know, how much he respects him and all this. And they are then interrupted by Professor Travers being brought in, and he's very unhappy. He's sort of been forced to come in here. And it turns out his daughter had him brought here, and the soldier doesn't want him and says, this is a military matter. Of course, we don't know what that means yet. And Travers points out the military hasn't had much success. And the journalist tells Travers that the government decided to only allow one journalist down here, and he was chosen. He tries to interview Travers, who's very cantankerous and refuses to answer questions. But then he makes a speech about how it's unlikely they'll be able to defeat this menace and the whole of England might be completely wiped out.
Okay. Yeah, not a real optimist.
In the TARDIS, the Doctor has put together a machine that he says does nothing, but it'll apparently do something once they get moving again.
Yeah, it's just like a box with a lever on it, if I remember right.
And the web encasing the TARDIS suddenly disappears, and the Doctor uses his new machine to take the TARDIS in an unexpected direction. So I guess it's kind of a randomizer or something, so that they can elude their captor. And they've landed somewhere dark, and it turns out to be the London Underground. Convent Garden, or Convent, I don't know how to say that.
Covent Garden.
Yeah, I wrote it down. Covent Garden. Now, here's something that is really amazing with the story. They had applied for permission to film in the London Underground, and they were denied. And so everything you're seeing here is sets. The sets were so good that the London Underground people called them up and were like, what the hell? We told you you couldn't film. What did you do? And this story is actually kind of famous for how good the sets are, because it really looks like the Underground. I mean, they did an amazing job with that.
Yeah, they did a fine job with it. They're not big, expansive sets. They're still your Doctor Who, if you tilt the camera 5 degrees either way.
Right, and of course, you know, every time we see people walking through, they're just using the same few feet of different sets. But if someone told you it was filmed in the Underground, you probably wouldn't have any reason not to believe it, right? So they just did a really nice job with that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a funny bit here where the Doctor says, oh, it's funny, we keep landing on your Earth. So there's a couple of put a lantern on it things in this story.
Yeah.
And they then reach an exit gate upstairs, and they realize it's the middle of the day, yet London is silent. And they find an old man leaning against a gate, but when they talk to him, he falls over, and he's dead and covered in webs.
Yeah, a little grim.
And the newspaper kiosk next to him has, you know, this one of those big, you know, things they do. It says, Londoners flee, menace spreads. Again, you know, we keep being told about this menace, but I don't know what it is yet. You know, maybe it's more serious than the undersea menace or whatever it was.
What's that?
Well, the undersea menace, the Atlantis one that was...
Well, he was going to blow up the world, wasn't he? Yeah. That was pretty menacing.
Jamie then steps down onto the subway tracks, and the Doctor freaks out that he's going to get electrocuted, but it turns out the current has been turned off. And the Doctor realizes no trains have run in some time, and they come across a power cable, and then they hear people coming, and they hide in a little cubby. And by the way, this is one of the areas where you can tell when they're repeating the set, because this little cubby that people can hide in gets reused about 5 different times. It's supposed to be different places in the tunnel system.
Yeah, I can think of at least 3 off the top of my head. So, yeah.
And some soldiers come through reeling out a cable. You know, they got a big round wooden thing with the cable wrapped around it that they're doing.
Spool, yep.
Yep, so that's a good word for it. One of the soldiers is Staff, the Staff Sergeant. I really like this guy. He's got a very sort of set face. He totally looks like a military person. I looked him up, and, you know, he was in all sorts of stuff. And one of the things he played was the professor in the 1976 The Witch in the Wardrobe series that the BBC did.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's neat. Yeah, he does have kind of a seasoned, old-school soldier type atmosphere to him.
He died kind of young. He died at 64, only about 10 or so years later than this. And he, one of the things he would do is he would play sickly people, and especially like homeless people, because he had a problem with his lungs. And so he could, on command, like sort of have a bubbly, you know, disgusting lung sound. So that was his specialty.
Probably not the talent I'd wish for, but it's certainly a talent.
You go with what you got.
Yeah.
So Jamie and Victoria follow the soldiers. The Doctor goes off on his own. And, of course, Jamie and Victoria get caught. And the Doctor is following the cable that they were laying. He finds a batch of explosives at the end of the cable. And then he hears the familiar sound of a control unit. And he hides, you know, underneath the platform. And a Yeti appears on the platform above him. Elsewhere in the tunnels, we see Anne Travers, and she's bringing some equipment into a room. And the journalist there is upset that Professor Travers won't talk to him. at some point, a soldier asks Ann Travers what a girl is doing in a job like this. And by the way, I'll say, you know, we mentioned this previously in The Enemy of the World. There was an actress that was particularly smart. I think this is a very smart actress. She really, you know, I think holds her own and has presence in this. And she has her little zinger here, which I referenced at the beginning. She, you know, when he wants to know what a girl is doing here, and she's like, when I was a little girl, I thought I'd be like to be a scientist, so I became a scientist. And it's a surprisingly good line, right? Now the soldiers who were running the cabling show up and let them know that they captured Jamie and Victoria. And Anne asks the soldiers to find out from Jamie and Victoria if anyone else is down there before they blow up the tunnel. She doesn't want to blow up a human. And of course, Jamie and Victoria, because they don't know about the explosives, they lie and say that they were alone. And then they're told that the tunnel is being blown up. And, you know, Victoria says, the doctor. And the explosion is set off. And the doctor is right next to the explosives. And he yells and falls. And we see the explosive glowing.
Yeah, which is not the way explosives usually explode. But,
and that's the end of the episode.
Well, we get a little recap of that at the beginning of the next episode. And then Jamie and Victoria are locked up in a room together in this little underground headquarters base that the soldiers have. Jamie says he wishes he'd told the soldiers about the doctor being in the tunnels earlier, because maybe they wouldn't have tried to blow them up so soon. Well, the staff sergeant who's outside in the command center, I think these two rooms, the room where they're being held, is adjacent to the command center, which is where all the, you know, military flooding and stuff goes on. So in that next room, or very nearby at least, the staff sergeant, it'll turn out his name's Arnold, he goes out into the tunnels to check on the doctor. And they had a blast detector, I guess it's kind of a seismograph type thing, that didn't register any explosion. One of the men speculates that this doctor, who they haven't actually seen yet, he could have sabotaged that bomb. Mm-hmm. So they go in and start interviewing Jamie and Victoria, and Anne is a little reassuring here. She doesn't know how the doctor is, but she says there's at least no bad news about him yet. But then there's an interruption as the interviewing is starting, and just as they're starting to weasel a little bit of information out of Victoria, one of the soldiers comes in and says that somebody's on the line, and there's trouble. And the other soldier asks Yeti, and then they all leave together, except for Jamie and Victoria are left behind, of course. They're under suspicion now. Jamie says, Yeti? Did he say Yeti?
What you think about is an interesting little continuation, because in Enemy of the World, there was the point where they said Jetty, and you know, yeah, the doctor thought they said Yeti.
Yeah, it was a dilapidated Yeti. Back in the command center, the phone call, these soldiers are still on the line, and now it's just gunfire, and after a moment of that, we hear a kind of a despairing yell, almost a scream, but not quite that shrill, but it's not a happy yell. So more men are sent out to check on those other men. Chorley, the reporter, he is unusually weaselly in this scene. You know, he's one of the soldiers is going out, and I think he asks if Chorley wants to go along, and he says he'll stay here so as not to get in the way.
Well, and the reporter knows that, right? He's kind of cowing. I mean, because Chorley keeps complaining about not being involved and not being told things, and so the soldier's like, "Well, come along with us. We're going to have this fight." And he's like, "Oh no, that's okay."
Yeah, so Chorley says he'll stay here, and I think the soldier replies something like, yes, I think you'd better head. You know, he's very very critical in his response. So at Charing Cross Station is where those explosives were piled up. It turns out they find the detonator, and it was fired. You know, it did what it was supposed to do, or tried to do what it was supposed to do. And there's a little bit of scrap on the floor, but there's no evidence of any kind of explosion of a stack of crates of explosives. And then we see back at the headquarters. This headquarters, by the way, is at Gouge Street Station, which You know, I've read that for years and years, and I always assumed it was Goodge Street, but it's Goodge Street, like, I don't know, like it rhymes with Nuge, like Ted Nugent, you know, the Nuge, the Googe. So the professor opens up one of the control spheres, and he's examining it. It's got a bunch of technological gewgaws and gimcracks inside of it, and Anne tells her father that there are two youngsters here who know the Yeti are robots and know about the control spheres. And the professor says, but they can't have. I mean, the public were never told. And back in their room, Jamie and Victoria discuss the vast space intelligence that's coming back to make more trouble. Jamie thinks it must be what trapped the TARDIS in webs. Anne and her father come in. And Victoria starts to get a very sweet smile on her face as she recognizes the professor, and she tells him her name, Victoria Waterfield, and Jamie McCrimmon. And Travers is kind of taken aback. He says, but it can't be. Why, that's over 40 years ago. And Jamie still hasn't recognized him. She says, Jamie, don't you recognize him? It's Professor Travers. So there's a brief but heartwarming reunion, and it ends up that Jamie and the professor are going to go see if the doctor's turned up yet, and Victoria will stay back here and explain the whole situation to Anne. So Jamie and Travers meet the staff sergeant and the others in the command center. Arnold's staff sergeant, he says there weren't no explosion, is what he says.
His phrase is pretty funny there.
Yeah. The ammo was tampered with, and he guesses it was the doctor. Hmm. Travers replies, what rot, Arnold. The doctor's a friend of mine. I don't know his real name, but the doctor is a friend of mine. So Jamie thinks he might know where the doctor is, and Arnold says he'll go with him. Back in the headquarters, or in the little room where Victoria and Anne are, Victoria tells Anne that the TARDIS travels through time and space. And Anne is
as usual with Victoria, you know, whenever she can spill too many beans, you know, she does in this story. It's not really a problem to talk to Anne, but it'll come up later.
Yeah, she's Trevor's daughter. She's got to be all square. Although it would be a fun twist if she turned out to be evil, but we'll see. Anyway, Anne asks when she met him. It was, she had said, in 1935 in Tibet. And Chorley comes in, the reporter, and it quickly becomes obvious that Anne doesn't like him. She tells him, you have a reputation for distorting the truth. You take reality and you make it into a comic strip. In short, Mr. Chorley, you are a sensationalizer. And he begins to reply, you smug little red brick university. And she cuts him off and says something about how she has sharp claws and something to that effect. So I did a little research on this, and Red Brick University is actually a term that's used in Britain. It's it was originally kind of an insult, because Red Brick Universities, there were, depending on what you read, there were between 6 and 9 of them originally, I guess. And they were kind of like, sort of budget universities, or at least they weren't as fancy and high-toned as Oxford and, you know, that lot. But nowadays, I guess, the red brick universities tend to be pretty highly rated among international edifices of learning. So
that was a good catch. I didn't even notice that little extreme.
So that's what that means. And Chorley, now it's not clear if Chorley was from a fancier university or if he just was, you know, from a really, you know, low quality university. But in either case, he didn't like Anne's origins in the Red Brick University. Enough on that. Chorley speculates that Victoria could tell him a few things about the Yeti. He notes it was quite a coincidence she came when she did. And this gave me a brilliant idea. My new name for the TARDIS, it's the Coincidus. Yep, you'll be hearing a lot of that in podcasts to come. Anyway, Chorley says there was no explosion. The doctor probably sabotaged it. And Jamie and Arnold have gone to look for him. So that's worrying for Victoria, because now two of her companions are out in the souk, as it were. In a subway tunnel, there's a bunch of British soldiers being approached by two Yeti.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a scene of a Yeti carrying a gun, which is not something I remember from Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually we find out that this gun is not a shooty bullet type gun. It's a web gun. But the web guns are powerful enough that they can take out humans. And they, in fact, web up two guys who apparently die or are at least paralyzed.
Although it's not like a Spider-Man shooting a web thing. It just kind of spits out like mist that ends up turning into a web.
Yeah, kind of congeals into it. Well, there's a spray, isn't there, that you can use for, oh, maybe I'm thinking of snow spray for like windows in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's kind of like that anyway. So these surviving soldiers, they retreat from the approaching Yeti, and they meet Jamie and Arnold, who are looking through the tunnels. One of the men brought a pile of explosives. I don't know, you know, if he brought it in a cart or what. He couldn't very well have just, you know, put it in a backpack because it's a big pile. But just as he's talking about it and getting ready to shoot it and blow it up, the Yeti start webbing it. And he was just a little too late, it turns out, because when he shoots it, we do hear the light and sound of an explosion, but then the light fades, the smoke clears, and we see these crates of ammunition are still contained by the webs. But but they're glowing, as we saw with the stack of ammunition that blew up next to the doctor earlier. So the webs apparently are strong enough to contain these very large explosions, and the Yeti keep advancing. Meanwhile, back at headquarters, Anne is skeptical about the TARDIS. She's alone right now with her dad, Travers. They're talking, and Travers admits he's never seen the TARDIS. He's only been told about it. So Anne starts speculating that the doctor, both the times when Travers has been around living, moving Yeti, the doctor has also been around, and she speculates the doctor controls them.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria, it happens, is listening outside the door, you know, eavesdropping very deliberately, a little sneak. But finally, she enters with tea. But before she does that, Travers tells his daughter what she's saying is ridiculous. The doctor saved Ditsen Monastery. And believe it or not, I didn't remember that story arc was called The Abominable Snowman, but I did remember the monastery was named Ditsen. So pretty good, I'd say. Anyway, there are more Yeti out in the tunnels now with the soldiers. I think maybe just one more. I think there may only be three of them, but I'm not sure. But these Yeti, now they're not doing anything. They're not approaching. They're just sort of standing around as we saw them doing back in Tibet back in the day. But then all of a sudden they start beeping and they wander away. Jamie wants to follow them and spy on them, but another soldier says, don't push your luck.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the headquarters, two of the soldiers are talking about the Yeti. One says they're from space. The other says they're from a foreign power. He speculates that the fungus in the tunnels is a bacteriological warfare. One of the soldiers mentions that if you can hit the Yeti right between the eyes, it kills them. So either the soldiers down here are lousy shots, or the vulnerable spot is very small. Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah, mostly they have big heads. I mean, normally you don't want to try to shoot someone in the head because it's hard, but their heads are nice and big.
And it also turns out that hand grenades stop them, but they don't have any hand grenades. So I guess they should have kept some around after World War II, probably.
Well, what they really needed were those hand grenades from the war machines, the ones that, like, stopped all, you know, everything from happening, all electronic stuff and all that.
Oh, is that the ones that the tanks, the tanks threw those out. I don't remember. It was a long time ago, but yeah. Anyway, they don't have any hand grenades, so there's no point in that. Maybe they'll find a trash. Trove and cash at the same time. I said trash. They'll find a cache or a trove of them later on, maybe. Who knows? Now, there's a lighted subway map on the wall, which is, you know, kind of a thing that I've always liked the aesthetics of those subway maps. And there's a game now called Mini Metro that basically you build your own subway map. I've only played a few minutes of it, but before that game came out, I actually wrote my own video game that used a subway map, and I didn't, you know, try selling it or anything. It was just sort of a fun little novelty thing I did with Beyond. But so anyway, I like subway maps, so this is kind of fun to see, even though it's just in black and white. The subway map is lighted. All the routes are lighted, and there are some dark sections, including a good arc of what's called the circle line, which is sort of like a central oval, that some of the lights are out in that section of it, and more of the lights are going out. It kind of flickers, and then the light dies. And this means that the fungus in the tunnels is on the move. We've heard those men talk about the fungus briefly, but we haven't actually seen it yet. And we did see it in the Tibet episodes, and it's changed a little since then. We'll get to that in a moment. Back in the headquarters, the doctor asks Anne for help tinkering with one of these spheres. His hands are shaking with age. He's definitely...
Well, you said the doctor, but I think you mean Professor Travers.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, he's a professor, so he probably is a doctor or something. But yeah, when I typed that, I didn't mean the doctor. I meant the doctor. But yeah, the professor asks Anne for help. One of the soldiers reports that fungus stuff, it's on the move again. Houston Square's gone. So the doctor and Anne, they go to the command center, and now King's Cross has gone out, and it's moving on to Farringdon. So they're just subway stations are being knocked out left and right by this fungus stuff. Anne says it's never moved as fast as this before, and we find out that, in fact, for the last 3 weeks, it hasn't moved at all. And Chorley, the journalist, says, strange, isn't it, that all this should happen on the very day that your mysterious doctor friend turned up? The professor thinks that Victoria's in the common room, which is the room where she and Jamie were imprisoned at first. But it turns out she's not in there, because one of the soldiers was just in there before coming out here. And we get a little cutaway of her wandering alone in a tunnel looking for Jamie and the doctor, which is probably not a great idea, but I guess it speaks well for her bravery, if nothing else. So the soldiers back in the tunnel, the soldiers who were there with the Yeti, who almost had him dead to rights, but then just decided to wander away for no apparent reason, those soldiers hear singing. And when I was listening to this singing, I was almost convinced it was the doctor, because there was some little tone in the voice that made me think that it was Troughton. But no, it's actually a different soldier, and he's also a Welshman. He says he was a driver in the ammo truck to Holborn, and they got jumped by Yeti. So he escaped. When he got down into the tunnels, he says there was some cobweb thing, which is the fungus. It was moving down the tunnel, and it was moving behind a Yeti that was carrying a pyramid. Now, he doesn't use the word pyramid, but after Jamie questions him, he thinks it's the same thing. And Jamie says if you smash that pyramid, it'll knock out the intelligence. So he wants to go pyramid hunting. And this Welsh guy, Evans, he wants to go along. And he's not part of this army unit, so no one else objects. After the rest have left and Jamie and Evans are alone, Jamie says, thanks. Evans says, don't be daft, boyo. First chance I get and I'm skipping.
Yeah, and I also liked this actor. He's very good at, you know, playing a sort of cowardly guy. So I looked him up. Now, normally, you know, you look up these people and it's like, oh, they had this long, you know, stage career and this and that and the other thing. And all I could find was, well, he was in a couple of Doctor Who's and this, and then he died in 2010. I'm like, okay. Huh. So I'm going to assume he had more of a career than that, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe he just went into a different field. You know? He might have been a very productive real estate agent or something. Who knows? So back in the command center, the lighted map is getting darker, especially the inner circle, the circle line, they call it. Liverpool Street is gone now. Out in the actual subway, Jamie stops at one of the stations to check her subway map there. Back at headquarters, it turns out that Charing Cross and the Temple have gone, so this fungus is really having a banner day for knocking on subway stations. And Charlie wants to leave. He's, understandably concerned. It seems like the whole subway is falling to this fungus. Victoria is still outside, or still out in the tunnels, looking for the doctor, but there's someone else in the tunnel with her who she hasn't yet noticed. We just get a glimpse of kind of a military-looking boot. Back in the headquarters, Charlie says Cannon Street and Tower Hill have gone now, which means the only station left on the Circle Line is called the Monument Station. And wouldn't you know it, that's exactly the station that Jamie and Evans have just arrived at. And at either end of the platform, the arriving and departing tunnels are full of a glowing goo. And here we can see that the intelligence, the fungus incarnation of the intelligence, has changed its style over the last 35 years or so. In Tibet, it was kind of like tendrils that grew and, you know, clambered over everything. But this is more like the blob, or even more like suds being squeezed out of a tube. In fact, I'm 95% sure that's what it was. It was just some kind of soap suds.
Yeah, because they did a really good job at it, but when we're looking at the tunnel that's coming through there, the tunnel is a miniature, right? So it really is just some soap suds inside a miniature, even though they did a really good job on the miniature.
Yeah, it's not bad all in all, but it definitely, if you really squint at it, you can tell there it's got those bubbles in it that are sort of a dead giveaway.
Yeah.
Jamie says, "We're trapped." And Evan says, "We've had it, boyo. We can't go forward and we can't go back." That's the end of the episode with a terrifying cliffhanger. It's not bad, actually.
Well, you know, if you soaked in it for too long, your fingers might get...
You're soaking in it.
Yep. So episode 3, and this is the reconstruction episode. Well, like I said, it's not too bad. There are some confusing moments I'll mention, but for the most part, it's pretty good.
Yeah. It is just... I actually, when I realized that, you know, about a minute into it, and I realized it was just going to be a reconstruction, I remembered what you had said about these episodes being recovered, so I looked it up, and that's where I found out that apparently what happened is the guy recovered all the episodes, and one of them got stolen on his trip back to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
People theorize that it's in some private collector's hands now, and you mentioned some people suspected that he had used it to his own advantage, that maybe he sold it off to somebody, but we weren't speculating about that particular episode, but you...
Right.
I think you said you had heard that people had doubted his good intentions one way or another, so that could be one reason for it, but... Anyway, it's a pity, but they did have that service that comes in and takes snapshots throughout the production of the show.
What's really unfortunate here is that there's the introduction of a hugely important character, so we miss seeing that in video. Sorry, but yeah, like you said, they didn't always do it. And I wrote this, you know, before seeing your description of the intelligent stuff. So I said, the dishwashing liquid is invading.
Yeah, it is what it is. You know?
And Jamie and was it Evan? I called him the driver. Are surrounded.
Yeah.
And then they see a Yeti holding the intelligence pyramid. And Jamie tells Evan to shoot it. And he shoots a few times and hits it. And there's an explosion. And then right at the beginning, we have one thing that is confusing. Like, there's an explosion, and we hear some dialogue, something about it not working. We just don't know what happened. We can't see. I mean, maybe they got, you know, maybe they managed to spiderweb it or something. I don't know, but... So meanwhile, Victoria is still in a tunnel looking for the doctor, and suddenly we see a soldier holding the doctor hostage. You know, this was the boot in the previous one. And this actor was, I don't know if you recognized him, he was previously in the Daleks Master Plan.
Did not recognize him.
But this is his first appearance as Colonel Lethbridge Stewart. And this character will be one of the most major characters in the history of the series in terms of how long he's around.
Oh, really?
And how important he is. Yep. So like I say, it's unfortunate that we don't get to see his introduction live.
Yeah. Well, in theory, that other episode is still out there somewhere.
Yeah, that's true.
You never know.
Now, this colonel is skeptical of everything. He wants to know what's going on down here, and he decides to take them back to headquarters, you know, the central area where the soldiers are. Now, the soldiers at headquarters have no idea who the colonel is, and they wonder where he showed up from. And as we'll see, an important thing here that's been kind of coming together, and especially come together in this episode, is that, you know, we come to realize somebody here is a traitor. And I think they do a pretty good job of giving multiple candidates, right? So you don't necessarily know who it is. And so with everyone speculating, like, who's this colonel guy? None of us have ever heard of him. He showed up out of nowhere. And he says he's taking over from Pemberton. So that's the guy we just heard a very brief mention of in the first episode as having died. And the colonel hands over his papers proving who he is. And he says he got here as part of the ammo group, but everyone else died. But again, this is suspicious because, you know, Evan, the driver, also survived, and he didn't say anything about a colonel. So, you know, nothing's kind of adding up here. And then Travers shows up and has a warm reunion with the doctor. This is the first time in the story that he's seen him, and he's very happy to see him. And he takes him back to his lab. And we now get the doctor's explanation for why he was missing last episode. And again, even while we were talking about it, I kind of forget because I think they did it pretty smoothly. But he sort of explains that, well, in that, you know, first episode when there was the explosion at the end, I got knocked out and then I woke up and I was sort of confused and I wandered around the tunnels for an episode. So meanwhile, Jamie and the driver, Evan, are still in the tunnels and they're using the London Underground map to get around. I don't know how familiar you are with this. The London Underground map is this very, very famous thing. And it's actually kind of groundbreaking in terms of technical writing or technical communication because it provides in a very simplified and easy to follow manner what the routes are, but it's not realistic at all. So, for example, there are people who will see that two stops out in the, you know, boondock somewhere are close together, and they'll say, oh, why don't we go to this one and we'll walk to the other stop and see what, you know, see the area. And actually, they're miles and miles apart, right?
They're not to scale.
Right. So the whole thing is there conceptually. It's not intended to be an accurate map. And there's a whole, like, documentary and books about it and everything, and interesting guy who designed it and all this. The guy who designed that map refused to go on vacation because he worried that if he was on vacation, they would make some change to the whole system and he wouldn't be there to adjust the map for it.
Yeah, well, I guess it's good for commuters that he had priorities like that.
Meanwhile, Evan wants to take breaks for chocolate. Jamie's very impatient, wants to get on with it. At headquarters, the journalist is now desperate to leave. He says, the world must know what's going on down here. And Travers tells the doctor that it's all his fault because of what he brought back from Tibet. And I think he might have mentioned before, but now he confirms, you know, one of the control spheres was intact. And naturally, he wanted to figure out how it worked. And the doctor's like, sure. And then one day it disappeared, right? Meanwhile, the colonel has, since he's come in and take over control, he's announced a required briefing, which no one's happy about. Who wants to go to one of these required meetings?
Started already.
That's just like, you know, the assemblies, the required assemblies in high school, and we'd do everything to escape them. Yeah. In the tunnels, Evan lets Jamie know that he's escaping when they reach the next station. And Jamie says, all you want to do is save your own skin. And I liked his response, look, it's the only one I got. And he then runs off. And in the briefing, they're looking at an overhead view of a mysterious mist that started surrounding London. And then fungus was found in the underground. And then the Yeti showed up. And actually, it is kind of a useful briefing because, you know, the TARDIS crew didn't know all this history, right? And the doctor hangs a letter. The doctor hangs a lantern on the Yeti costuming having changed by pointing out they've changed in appearance. And especially given that the first one was brought back by Travers, I'm not quite sure how that would work. But.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it's just like the Mark II, whatever the Yeti. Presumably, the Yeti built the other Yeti.
Yeah, they are robots. That's true. And actually, someone in there actually says it's Mark II. Yeah, I think Travers does. And nothing they've tried, you know, to handle this has worked. And so the doctor and Ann Travers and, you know, Professor Travers are informed that everyone is relying on you three to come up with a solution. Also, to make matters worse, the mist absorbs all radio waves and the Yeti have destroyed the phone lines. So makes things tougher.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever heard of a mist that absorbs radio waves?
It could happen.
Yeah, it could. I'm just trying to think. I've never heard of anything like it in real life that I can recall.
All I can think of is like the fog, which I don't think I've ever seen. It's a John Carpenter one and all of it. Yep.
Yeah. Like lead is supposed to block, you know, x-rays and stuff like that. So it could be a lead mist, but you'd think it wouldn't hang in the air very well.
Right.
Don't know.
Well, if the history of movies tells us anything, it's, you know, creeping mist is never good. The journalist shows up at the briefing, and it's kind of funny because, you know, he's supposed to be informed all the time of what's going on. You know, he's a journalist who was sent down here to represent all the other journalists, and of course nobody ever tells him anything, so he didn't know about the briefing. And he argues with the colonel, and he says, you know, why don't we just get lifted out by a helicopter? And the briefing breaks up, and the journalist plots on how they can escape, and the soldier he's talking to realizes that the glowing map on the wall is now showing the fungus taking over more of the underground. And back in the tunnels, Jamie and Evan run into each other again. And, you know, this Evan guy, you know, in true fashion, he's like, oh, yeah, you know, you talked me into it. It really would be wrong to leave. But it turned out that he just couldn't find an unlocked door. And the journalist is still bugging the colonels. This is just kind of, you know, needlessly cruel. The colonel assigns him a very important job. He's going to be coordinating everyone. So they're going to sit him in a room with some paper and stuff, and people will come to him and tell him whatever he needs to know, and he'll sort of just make everything work. And it's a really important job. So,
yeah. Although, if I'm now, I've only seen the first three episodes, but so far my money is on this journalist being the mole for the Yeti people and the intelligence and all that. So if that's the case, then this is, he's right where he wants to be now.
Yeah,
he's the central information clearinghouse.
Sure, everybody. But the reality is nobody's going to give him any information, right? This is just a ruse to stick him in a room somewhere so he'll shut up. <you know? laughs> So the doctor recommends using explosives to seal themselves into the underground so the fungus can't get out. But they have the problem that the Yeti keep cocooning all their explosives. And the doctor has the idea of using a mobile trolley on the track so the explosives will be on the move. And then here's another confusing thing. There's some kind of machinery, sort of maybe a train track thing or a bell or something. And we then see a hand do something and maybe sabotaging it. I could not tell what it was.
Yeah.
And I think it's an important plot point, but I just had no idea what it was presenting. And they didn't put themselves. There's one or two points where they put text on the screen, and here they didn't. It would have been helpful. Then Victoria finds a little Yeti statue, just like the ones used in Tibet to control the Yeti.
Yeah, the master of the monastery had a little chessboard and moved him around.
And Ann Travers says, well, we have three of these statues, but Victoria points out there's only two. And the doctor looks disturbed, and we then see a mysterious hand holding the missing statue and moving it. And when he does that, we see a Yeti activate and start to move.
Mm-hmm.
And they're ready to do the explosion to seal the underground, but Victoria is worried that Jamie will be trapped. Then we see a Yeti, presumably the one that just started being controlled, and it approaches the room where all the explosives are stored, and it rips off the padlock. The doctor then says, when the trolley is pushed down the tracks, it will explode in 60 seconds. But then they find out that there was some main door was found open, and then the explosives door was ripped off. And the doctor goes and checks the explosive room, and guess what? It's full of, you know, dishwashing liquid. And the doctor points out to the colonel that someone here is in league with the Yeti, and must have opened the main door for them. We don't really know why they would have had to open the main door, but okay. Somebody had to make it possible for them to do this.
Yeah, well, I think the main door, that's just to let the foam in. Although I don't know why, if they could put it in that room, they couldn't have just spread it throughout the whole facility.
Yeah.
I don't know. It could be a plot hole here. I don't know. We'll see. And now, still got three episodes.
We see that Victoria is, as usual, running her mouth, and she's telling the journalist everything. You know, they've got a time machine. It's called the TARDIS. And she lets slip that they're going to blow the tunnel, which they'd been trying to keep from the journalist. The doctor comes in.
They use the information clearinghouse. Yeah. See? This is what I'm saying.
Yeah. The doctor comes in, and the journalist leaves. And Victoria says the journalist doesn't want the explosion to happen because it'll cut him off from the TARDIS. And this is really unusual because usually the doctor is sort of gentle towards Victoria, and he just explodes in anger that she told the journalist about the TARDIS that she was such an idiot. And guess what? It turns out the journalist on the way out locked the door on them. And the journalist then encounters Jamie in the tunnels and the driver and goes past them. And Jamie finally reaches headquarters and tells the doctor that the journalist passed them. Then Travers and his daughter hear a scream outside the room they're in. One of the soldiers has been killed. Travers finds a Yeti statue on the ground, and the Yeti shows up behind him. And it's the end of the episode.
So I wonder if Travers can use this statue to control one of the Yeti. Or if you have to have special privileges, you know, a security badge or something.
Right. That's a reasonable question. I wouldn't surprise, because I also have not, I haven't watched this in 10 years, so I don't remember how it goes, so it wouldn't surprise me if that was part of the answer. So we were kind of referring to this at the beginning. What's your feeling about the first three episodes?
I found them pretty interesting, fairly enjoyable. You know, I'm not getting my hopes up too high. I'm fully prepared to be disappointed by the next three episodes, but. Still, it's an interesting start. It is kind of fun to have a continuation of a past story, because we don't get that a whole lot so far in Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. You know, something happens, they do it, and then they go on to the next situation, and that's that. So, you know, and especially nowadays in the past, 10, 20 years, whatever. Well, hell, now more like 25 or 30 years. There's been that increasing tendency for TV series to have story arcs, right. You know, things that aren't just self-contained sitcom episodes, but then actual state changes that persist from episode to episode. So that's, it's kind of fun and interesting to see even the small indication of that, you know, with these callbacks to the Tibet adventure and all that. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting, refreshing stuff. I didn't really notice the quality of the sets as I was watching it. You know, they didn't outrage me, but I didn't think like, wow, that's a really good subway tunnel. But yeah, looking back on it, that's probably exactly the effect that they wanted. You know, they wanted right. you to just take it as a subway tunnel and there you go.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to me so far. We'll see if the next three can hold my interest or dash what little hopes I have on the rocks.
2 weeks later.
So episode 4, the Yeti closes in on Travers, his daughter tries to help him. It's always funny and confusing to me that, you know, his daughter in the show is not his daughter in reality, it was Victoria. We see Travers' body being dragged by the Yeti, and the doctor and company are going down a tunnel, as is the colonel and staff, and they encounter a couple of soldiers. It seems like the intelligence just always knows their movements. And the TARDIS crew finds that the fungus has closed off their access to the TARDIS, which is always unfortunate. The doctor slices into the intelligence webbing and gets kind of a psychic blowback. He wanted to, like, take a sample of it. So everyone discusses who might be the traitor, and the doctor tells the colonel about his police box, which, I don't know, when you're worried about someone being a traitor, might not be a good idea, and the colonel decides their new mission is to rescue the TARDIS, because why wouldn't you go and get a time and space machine?
Sure. Yeah, if you're with the military, you'd like to get one of those for your research and development.
Yep. And Anne Travers is upset that her father is gone, and she tells the doctor that she and her father were about to connect the sphere to the control unit, but she doesn't see what that would have to do with anything. And she and the doctor go off and talk technical stuff. And then the driver, Evans, brings in one of the Yeti statues and gives it to the doctor. And it really pisses off the doctor. He's like, you just brought a homing device and handed it to me. The colonel directs his soldiers to capture the police box. And they're skeptical. Like, you know, of course, why are they worried about a police box? And there's just a lot of little shots and back and forth in all this. And, you know, I would say, unfortunately, the last three episodes, you know, could probably be like one.
Yeah.
A lot of walking through tunnels, wondering who's the traitor, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, they did really do a good job on those tunnels. So,
yep.
They got to make the maximum use out of them.
Eventually, Arnold, a guy named Staff, and Evans, and another soldier are contemplating going through some fungus to make their way. And Evans, of course, is a coward. He's a very, very consistent coward in this story.
Yeah.
And Staff decides he'll go forward, so he puts on a gas mask along with the other soldier. And the two of them go through the fungus slash webbing, and they scream. And Evans runs forward and finds that they've been wrapped in webbing.
Hmm. I think he just, does he just see the one soldier that isn't Arnold?
I think Arnold might. Yeah, I don't remember which one, but yeah, probably the other one, you're right. And we don't really know what happened to Arnold.
Yeah.
And on the surface, the colonel and his soldiers encounter the terrifying, very slow-moving Yeti. And we get a long combat sequence of soldiers shooting at Yeti and throwing grenades and the like. And I actually... You know, I had warned that there was some epic combat sequence that people were disappointed in. I thought, especially for Doctor Who up to this point, this was a pretty good combat sequence. There's lots of shots and lots of, you know, shooting and grenades and all this. But I kind of think that what people had in their minds for this was more than what they got.
Yeah. Yeah, the grenades in particular, I earlier they tried to sell us the grenades as the total solution to the Yeti. You know, as long as you have grenades, the Yeti will go down pretty easily. But they don't seem to help them a whole lot.
So after lots of combat, we see the doctor in a record store putting together components, and the Yeti invade the store and overcome the soldier and the doctor. But then their control units order them to go somewhere else. And the soldier is dead, and the doctor finds a Yeti statue in his pocket. And he realizes two statues were missing, so where is the other one? We then see the colonel and another soldier still fighting the Yeti. Eventually, the other guy's killed, and...
I started to figure out that... It must be with these soldiers who are still being chased by the Yeti.
So the colonel comes into the record store, and guess what? He's got one of the Yeti statues in his pocket. And two Yeti come in. Oh, and at this point, the doctor does what it seems like they should have done at the whole beginning of the story, which is he starts disabling the Yeti statues that he has so they can, he can't be used.
That's a pretty smart move. Yeah. Would have been a smarter move earlier, but better late than never.
So two Yeti come into the store, and they're accompanied by Dr. Travers. And it's the end of the episode. I definitely rushed through that one, but I think I covered all the important points.
And all the salient points, yeah.
So episode 5.
which was supposed to be mine, except when I got to the very end, right like a minute before you pointed it out to me, you sent me a text message. I realized, wait a minute, this is actually the last episode. Fortunately, we were able to work out something.
I wasn't going to say anything, but... So the intelligence speaks through Travers. And after defeating the intelligence in Tibet, the doctor has fallen for its carefully laid trap. It's kind of funny because I guess the trap was to defeat all of London and wait for the doctor to show up.
It is a thoroughly laid trap, if not a carefully laid one. Yeah.
And it has invented a machine that will drain all experience from the doctor's mind, and he will become like a newborn child. And to give the doctor incentive to submit to this machine, Travers takes Victoria and gives the doctor till the rest of the episode to make up his mind. In other words, he says 20 minutes, and I checked, and he said 20 minutes exactly 4 minutes into the episode. So there was, in fact, 20 minutes left in the episode. And it's also just one of those funny bad guy things, right? I'll give you the amount of time to decide this that will make the story work.
Yeah, give you just enough time to find a way to defeat me.
Yeah. So the intelligence leaves a couple of Yeti outside the door to keep them from leaving. And Driver Evans, once again, asks the obvious, you know, if the intelligence is going to leave the rest of them alone, if they turn over the doctor, then why don't they just turn over the doctor? And, you know, that's treated as a ridiculous question, but actually later on, people start agreeing with it, right? So.
Yeah, at least the colonel does.
The doctor promises if he can't find an answer, he'll give himself up. And then he tells Jamie that Jamie and Victoria will then need to take care of him because he'll be like a little child. That was kind of funny. Evans realizes...
But he'll still play the recorder, I bet.
Yeah. Evans realizes that the Yeti guards have left, so everyone but the doctor and Anne leave, and she and the doctor work on a solution for all this. They're trying to control spheres and Yeti and all that. And the colonel and Jamie go off to see what they can do, and they leave Evans to guard the doctor. And the colonel and Jamie open a door to find intelligent soap bubbles. Well, these are very big bubbles.
The bubble fungus.
Yeah. And they return to the doctor to be disappointed that the doctor has only figured out how to control a sphere. And he's, you know, actually typical sort of programmer-like person. He's very delighted that he can do this, but they're like, well, how's this going to help us? You know?
Yeah, reverse engineering a piece of equipment like that is fairly impressive. Or not fairly impressive. It's pretty much impossible to anybody but the doctor without, like, months of research. Oh, well.
Evans then holds the colonel and Jamie up at gunpoint, saying one of them must be in league with the intelligence. Now he's good. I mean, for being a coward, this is a pretty uncowardly thing to do because that's, you know, court-martial stuff.
Yeah. Well, if indeed one of them is in league with the intelligence, then he's a hero. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Travers has taken Victoria to the Yeti, and he is then released. His mind is released by the intelligence, and he comes back to his senses. He doesn't remember anything that's been going on.
Yeah. Also, Evans holding him at gunpoint, it's kind of like a low-budget version of the thing, you know, the paranoia and all that. It could be that, you know, there's some psychology.
Mentioned last time that they do a pretty good job of, like, okay, so somebody is the, you know, the traitor, and there's several possible people, and you don't know who it is, and, you know, yeah. So now a control ball, you know, a sphere rolls into the room with Evans, and he almost shoots it, but it turns out it's under the control of the doctor. And the doctor now spends, I don't know, like 3 minutes saying, look, I can make it go left. I can make it go right. I can, of course, like, okay, we got the point.
Yeah, good proof of concept.
And actually, Evan says what I was saying. He's like, oh, that's a pretty cool toy, you know, but how's it going to help us? And they're like, no, this isn't a toy. It's, you know, sophisticated equipment. But actually, of course, if you could have sold that as a toy, it would have been pretty good.
Didn't they sell, like, the droid from the first of the new Star Wars movies? Yeah. The little rolling ball? I think there was one of those you could buy.
And I will say, that's a, you know, BB-8, and that's a pretty cool robot, as was another robot created in the final film by J.J. Abrams. But what just really annoyed me about that was J.J. Abrams was just milking these movies, right? Because if he created a robot like BB-8, then he can get a piece of the merchandising and all that. And similarly, he put his friend, the actress that had been in some of his shows, in as one of the characters who has a helmet on the whole time, so she didn't actually have to be on set. And she, you know, was there like 5 minutes, and he put her in and gave her a bunch of money. I mean, he was just...
Oh, I remember reading about... She had like the chrome armor, and she was in the first movie, and then she just kind of really never went anywhere.
Yeah, she might not have been there till the third, I don't remember. But yeah, he was just... Yeah, he was just like, okay, I'm just going to suck up all the money here.
You know? So basically, he was a Doctor Who producer.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. So the Colonel and Jamie have been walking through the tunnels, because everyone's always walking through the tunnels, getting a little suspicious of each other, because, you know, somebody's got to be the traitor. Yeah. And they then encounter Staff, who's in bad shape. And I forgot to mention earlier, he showed up next to Travers sort of out of the blue. He's very messed up, kind of almost painted black, like from whatever happened to him. And he said, you know, what he entered the fungus earlier, and then he can't remember what happened after that, and he blacked out and came back. So they take him back to HQ because, of course, someone who has been through the fungus and can't remember what happened, you should bring them right back to your central control. The Doctor and Anne are going through the tunnels. Again, everyone's going through the tunnels. They find a Yeti and manage to control him. So they've now, because they had to create two different devices, one to control the sphere and one to control a Yeti.
Yeah, so they've got the sphere control, which is like a little box, and then they've got a little remote microphone thing where they can give voice commands to the Yeti. So they've got quite a 20 minutes well spent, I would say.
Staff and Evans, you know, go into a room, and it's actually a pretty well done miniature room, and you know, some intelligence goo breaks through the wall, and it's the end of the episode.
All right. Episode 6, the shocking conclusion of Web of Fear. So Staff Sergeant Arnold and Evans, the cowardly Welshman driver, are making their way through the tunnels together, and Arnold wants to go warn the others, but Evans has other plans, and as the British say, he scarpers. He runs off, and Arnold cusses at him, not actual cussing, of course, but, you know, it's he has harsh words for him, and he says something like, "I'll get you," or something to that effect. Elsewhere in the tunnels, the Doctor and Anne are walking around with a Yeti escort, and the Doctor has an idea that he tells Anne. He whispers it to her. The intelligence will figure out that the Doctor is controlling the Yeti at some point if he keeps doing it. So he uses the voice command box, or the microphone, to make this Yeti a sleeper agent. He tells it to wait 90 seconds while the Doctor and Anne move off, and then it's going to reactivate and return to business as usual under the intelligence's control until it's ordered otherwise. So it's a bit of a risky gambit, but it's worth a try.
I couldn't help to think, boy, Doctor pulled off some pretty good voice recognition for the time period.
Yeah, no kidding. So Jamie runs into them, and the Colonel arrives with Jamie. The Colonel says that Arnold saw the Professor Travers, and Arnold is okay, and the Professor's okay. Arnold was alive, of course, because Arnold talked, but he couldn't remember what happened when he went into the webs, as we just said. So, meanwhile, the Yeti reactivates after the 90-second shutdown, and it goes patrolling with two other Yeti. The Doctor's group now meets up with Arnold, and Arnold reports that the fungus has taken over headquarters. Yeti begin to approach from two different directions, so the group is trapped. Evans is around a corner, and he stays quiet as a Yeti passes by. But then he runs into another two Yeti, and they take him for a walk.
They, like, lift up both his arms, right, and just carry him, yeah.
Yeah. So in the Doctor's group, Arnold asks the Colonel to create a diversion so Arnold can make a break for it and potentially do something useful. So the Colonel trips and falls, and then all the commotion, Arnold sneaks away. The professor and Victoria end up in a control center room. It's got some little consoles and stuff, and it also has a big 6-foot-tall pyramid. It's like the pyramids, kind of like the pyramids we saw in the Himalayas episodes, but it's much bigger. You know, the ones we saw in the Himalayas were maybe like, I don't know, 1 foot tall or something. Right. This is a big one. It's as tall as a man. The professor says the doctor will have to submit to the intelligence, and the intelligence whispers over a loudspeaker and says it agrees. And this whispering, you know, we saw in the Himalayas episodes that when it was talking through the master of the monastery, it whispered too. And it's especially convenient in this case because it helps us maintain the mystery of who is speaking for the intelligence. And it says the doctor is the guest of honor, or will be when he gets here. Meanwhile, in the tunnels, the doctor's playing his recorder again as the humans sit in the tunnels surrounded by Yeti, who are apparently waiting orders. They're just standing around, not doing much. The doctor whispers to Jamie. He gives him the microphone. He hangs onto the control box for himself. He says he's lost track of which of the Yeti has controlled those, so Jamie's going to have to do some experimenting when the time comes. Elsewhere in the tunnels, Chorley, the weaselly little reporter guy, finds Arnold, Staff Sergeant Arnold. Chorley explains he couldn't get back to the headquarters. He got to the Piccadilly station, but he saw a machine, and the professor and Victoria were investigating it. I think that's the TARDIS he's referring to, but he ran off. Arnold comforts him and, you know, explains or just says basically, well, anybody'd be afraid in those circumstances. But he's also puzzled why didn't the Yeti get him? Chorley sees that Arnold's suspicious, but then Arnold just sort of shrugs it off and they move on together. So the doctor and Anne elsewhere, they're whispering together and the Yeti are still just ignoring them, just standing around. The doctor has the control box, not the microphone. Jamie is the microphone. But he's not going to use the control box now because he actually wants to meet the intelligence, he says. The colonel comes over, and he's speculating that the doctor may be thinking of giving himself up. And the colonel actually seems to be recommending it for the sake of saving Victoria and Travers, because the intelligence promised, for whatever its promises are worth, that it would let them go if the doctor gave himself up. And of course, this is a bit suspicious that the colonel seems to be recommending this course because it's exactly what the intelligence would recommend. So Evans arrives. He explains that he didn't desert, despite what Arnold said, but he tried instead a single-handed and desperate attempt, as he describes it, to save Travers and Victoria. The doctor hears one of the control spheres beeping, and the Yeti start moving. The doctor says, don't resist them. Jamie, meanwhile, is hiding in a trunk, and he peeks out. Further down the tunnel, a Yeti brings the doctor an electronic helmet, and the doctor puts it on. And it seems the rest of the group has just kept moving on. The doctor's here alone now. He tries the control box on this Yeti with no luck, and there's another Yeti right there, too, who doesn't seem to notice or be offended by the control box, but it also doesn't respond to it. In the pyramid room, Anne and the others, except for the doctor, they are finally escorted there by the Yeti. Back in the tunnels, Jamie uses the microphone to try summoning the Yeti. Now, he doesn't realize just how short the range on this thing is, and we saw it earlier when the doctor was testing it, but It's just got, like, you know, maybe a yard range thereabouts, but Jamie doesn't know that, so he's trying to call a Yeti, and as soon as he does that, one of them starts approaching, but it's not the right one. He tells it to raise its arm, and it doesn't, and after a moment, it just keeps shambling on. So he can kind of breathe a sigh of relief, except he turns, and there's another one right there menacing him, raising its claws and all that, so little bit of a scary surprise there. Finally, the doctor is brought to the pyramid room. The doctor assures everyone everything's under control. Don't do anything foolish. The intelligence is on the loudspeaker. It praises the doctor for cooperating Chorley is there, and he denies being the intelligence. He points to Arnold, who's wearing an electronic helmet a lot like the one the doctor has, which is your typical inverted bowl with some wires on the top
of it. Particular, like an inverted strainer. It's what that was look like.
And I'm trying to think. It seems to me there was some Hartnell episode where he had to wear a similar
thing. Well, remember there was the Web Planet one where the hair dryer kept coming down.
The hair dryer, that must be what I was thinking of, yeah.
But remember also they did the kind of strainer thing in Ghostbusters, right, when they put...
Louis Tully, put her, Vince Clortho. Okay, yeah.
So it's you know, strainers have turned out to be useful throughout time.
Yeah. They make good helmets, I guess. So the intelligence reveals it's controlling what is actually the corpse of Arnold. Arnold died when he went into the fungus, or perhaps even earlier. It's not entirely clear to me.
I call BS on the idea that he was the traitor all along. Like, he couldn't have put these different statues in people's pockets and everything. He wasn't around, you know. I don't know. I think they just chose him to be, but they didn't try to make it work logically in the story.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have made much more sense for Evans or someone to be it, because he was all over the place, but, you know.
Yeah, that's true. It would have had to have been much earlier for him to do all that stuff, but I don't know. Anyway, what we're seeing of Arnold now is dead Arnold, even though he's animated. And Arnold / intelligence threatens to break Jamie's neck. He has one of the Yeti grab him just to threaten the doctor. It's not actually going to break his neck just yet. But the doctor says he'll do what the intelligence says, but you got to let Jamie go. So the intelligence says, okay, but any funny business, Jamie's getting it. So the doctor goes and actually sits in the pyramid. There's a little seat in there for him. And Arnold, as the intelligence, says, soon your mind will be absorbed. And he says, complete cooperation is needed. Any opposition will be met with the punishment of the doctor's friends. And at this moment, Jamie uses the microphone, takes a chance that one of these Yeti in the room is the controlled one. And he orders, attack the Yeti. And one of them starts attacking the Yeti, and of course now, contrary to everything we might expect, the doctor says, no, he's very, very vocal about it, and Jamie and the others gang up on him and drag the doctor out of the pyramid, and the doctor's protesting and crying and, you know, all this stuff all the time, and not crying like tears, but crying
out. He has this trait where he gets very sort of childish, and he's like, and that's what he is here, and he's just very angry at everyone for having screwed up his plans.
Yeah. Now, from Jamie and the others' point of view, I mean, the doctor's got a big electronic helmet on his head. It's perfectly reasonable to think that maybe he's not in his right mind, but. When they get him out of the pyramid, there's a big explosion, or just a flash of white and a noise. I mean, it's not like we get some high-budget special effects or anything. When the smoke clears, the Yeti seem to be down for the count. The Arnold is de-reanimated, and the explosion has also put him in blackface for some reason. But Arnold finally gets to rest in peace anyway. And the doctor turns to Evans, the cowardly driver, and says, you blithering Welsh imbecile. He had to throw Welsh in there. He must have a grudge against the Welsh or something. And the doctor's angry. They've ruined everything. He reveals that he had crossed the wires on the helmet. So instead of the intelligence draining his mind, he would have drained the intelligence's mind. And maybe even learn some new space trivia or something. So that plan fell through, and he's really upset about it. And now the intelligence, instead of being dead, is still out in space somewhere. And the doctor now goes from being angry to being dejected. He says he's failed. But the others praise his victory. And he has at least for now defeated the intelligence. Maybe it'll come back in some future story arc, but for now it's been neutralized. London is saved. So the Doctor lightens up a little bit. And then Chorley starts telling the Doctor how he's going to be a celebrity. They'll go on television tomorrow and all that. And the Doctor doesn't like that idea at all. He says they have to go. And he and the crew quickly flee from this control room before anybody gets a chance to say their goodbyes or anything. So now it's just the non-TARDIS crew people left, the military people and Travers and Anne and so forth. And Travers and the others leave Anne to explain the TARDIS to Chorley. She's left alone with them. She doesn't seem particularly enthusiastic about it. So then we see the Doctor and Jamie and Victoria. They're in the tunnels, making their way, trying to make their way back to the TARDIS, but they're lost. And the Doctor says, they might suddenly start the trains again. Come on. So everybody looks very worried, and they get moving fast. Now, I think realistically, if I were running the transit authority, I would spend at least a week or two checking out the track and all that stuff, you know, before starting up the trains again. But
and if you want to add typical, you know, government bureaucracy on top of that,
you know. Yeah. Yeah, maybe half a year.
Exactly.
And that's the end of the episode.
I think this is those last three episodes, I think, the fastest we've ever gone through three episodes, for whatever that means.
Yeah. There was, overall, I thought the story arc was fun, but these last three episodes really, they were drawn pretty thin.
I thought. It was just, you know, okay, these guys will go down a tunnel. Now these guys will go down a tunnel. Now these guys will go down a tunnel. Yeah, it just, you know, like I said, it could have been one. Certainly not, didn't need to be three. Could have maybe been one episode.
Yeah.
Really good, probably good four-episode story.
Yeah. And this has me wondering, the way they ended it with them lost in the tunnels, we had one story arc where they were at the airport and, you know, they were smuggling people and shrinking them and, you know, taking them to the home planet so they could be inhabited by aliens. And all. It ended up that they were still at the airport and they went right into another story arc in that modern.
Yeah, I noticed that too, because of course you're expecting to see them take off in the TARDIS and instead they're just running down the tunnel. So, and I don't remember because I last watched this like a decade ago. So I don't remember if it goes directly into the next story or what, you know?
Yeah. I'm just, I could be all wrong, but it'll be at least mildly interesting to see where they pick up next time.
Yeah, I feel like in terms of, we talked about contrasting this in the last story because they were both found and people sort of changed their opinions. And like you said, I think there's a lot of good stuff in this story. It's just too long. And I think if I had to choose one to be recovered, I would choose Enemy of the World for multiple reasons. But one of them is that it is the rare, maybe only, six-episode story to justify six episodes, right? And even then, it went a little bit long. I mean, it had its own amount of running around in tunnels. But you know, halfway through, they added the whole new story element of the underground thing.
The bunker there,
which gave them a lot to work with in the last three episodes, where in this one, nothing changes in the last three episodes. Right? Absolutely nothing changes. There's no new element to it. No new person who shows up. No, you know, anything.
Yeah. I think the Salamander episodes are the better. Although I did enjoy a lot of things about these episodes too. But not as good as the previous story arc, I'd say.
Yep. So. Well, I guess getting back to the name or that I occasionally forget about. But so, well, it sounds like you would pretty much consider it worth watching if a little drawn out.
Marginally worth watching. I'd put it at, you know, pretty fair, but could have been much better with some tightening, you know, cut it down to four episodes. And, you know, I mentioned the thing, and they could have done more with the paranoia in these episodes.
Well, especially, like I said, because in the end, it just felt like they just chose someone and said, oh, that was it. But it didn't actually make any sense in the story, right? So
yeah, I don't think there's any way you could have deduced it. I mean, Arnold, for most of what we saw of him, seemed like the, you know, the sturdy, reliable
soldier. Right, and even at a point where we know in retrospect that he was taken over in these episodes, he was acting very noble and, it didn't make any sense.
Yeah, so the intelligence apparently knows a lot about British soldiers and how they think. So.
Right. And the next one is Fury from the Deep, and it's completely missing. I think it is. So we'll be watching the animated version, if I am correct here. So it's another one I know nothing about. And we'll see what we think when we get to it.
All right.